This is a talk on global testing, partly based on the work of Jelle Goeman, a PhD student of mine, jointly with Sarah van der Geer, who was one of the co-organizers of this whole workshop, although she only was present, I think, the first week, at least that's what she told me. And while being here, I've been working on extending this testing from testing for association to testing for predictability, and I will explain what I mean by that later on. So what we originally wanted is to have a test that would allow to test globally for association as a kind of screening tool in regression problems. In the same way, if you're a real classical statistical training, you do an F-test if you compare many groups before you go into the pairwise comparison. If the F-test is not significant, you don't do it. And so this must be something similar. If this global test is not significant, then you don't go in trying to do any regression models for the data you have. For if the number of predictors is smaller than the number of observations, the natural thing to do is to use the likelihood ratio test. And for p larger than n, we have this test by Jelle Goeman that I will be discussing. So I will review the global test, and it's linked with some old work on goodness of fit and spatial statistics. And then this switch from association to predictability, that's I think a different issue. The link with cross-validation, and then show that at the end we have a slightly different thing, and that checking for predictability is much harder than checking for association. So this is the classical linear model we will consider, and that's just for the sake of convenience. Is it the pointer? No. Anybody experience where the pointer is? I've got where. Which one is the pointer? No. Never mind. It's on the. That one? Oh. Well, never mind. I could use a stick if necessary. Yeah? This is much more traditional and much easier to use. This is going wrong. So we take linear classical normal regression model, we assume that the standard deviation is known and put it on 1. We want to test whether beta is 0 or not. And the likelihood ratio test is just this Hotelling's t-squared thing generalized to regression, where you estimate the beta and use this estimated covariance matrix to figure out its significance. And the power of that test somehow is invariant, it depends on the kind of explained variation in the regression problem. This is the effect of the predictors and divided by the total variation plus the variance of 1. And as I said, this is a useful instrument for model building. If this is not significant, somehow you better stop. For p larger than n, such a thing didn't exist, maybe. So Jelle Goeman started to work on this a couple of years ago when the whole hype of gene expression data started, and we really starting all to consider p larger than n problems from a different perspective. And that time, about six years ago, we organized a workshop in Leiden, Sarah and I, on p larger than n, and that by the kickoff of this PhD research. And this was published in Bioinformatics, and well, it's quite well cited. It gives him a lot of invitations to speak about it. modify for survival data. And I'm not going to talk about that today, but maybe a little bit next week. And the more mathematical background of what actually is going on is giving in a GRSSP paper that was published about 2 years ago. And to do it, we become, well, you could say, a bit Bayesian, not quite, or we go back to decision theory, you could say. Since the solving the very general problem is hard, there's no uniformly best test for testing beta zero against the general alternative, we have to do something, and to do something is that we put a prior on the alternatives, and we try to maximize the power averaged over the prior. So that's kind of decision theoretic concept, the average performance, and this averaging distribution is a distribution, but it's not a Bayesian thing, it's not a prior in the sense of being a Bayesian. But to do it, you have to compute the Bayes factor, the likelihood under the integrated alternative divided by the likelihood under the null, and you get a test statistic based on this thing. You get a p-value. If this is too large, you reject the null hypothesis, and you get your average power for over this distribution maximized and larger than the critical level alpha. You can do that, but then you have to the problem is what value of what distribution do you take? It's simple to describe, but not essential if you take normal distribution for this averaging distribution. So you can take a normal distribution in p-dimensional space with some covariance matrix, and you could define the global test by somehow taking the maximal effect you find. So you could take the sub over the taus for the test statistic or the infimum of the p-values. And that's the kind of thing they, by the way, they do in statistical genetics. They take the sub over the whole genome of the thing you find to test whether there's anything going on. The distribution theory of that sub and that infimum is getting quite complicated. So you get something easier, better to handle, and not defined depending on the choice of the distribution. If instead of trying to maximize to get the best power or the most significant test in this way by considering the local behavior in the neighborhood of tau squared equal to zero. So you, instead of finding a uniformly best test, we just go for a locally best test, and you get that locally best test by the score test for testing the null hypothesis against the alternative. And what you end up is having a mixed model in normal variables, whereas this is the standard deviation from the observations, and this is the covariance part coming from the mixing with this prior distribution. And you have to test tau squared zero against tau squared large in zero. You take the log of the derivative of the log of the density, and you get the score test. And the nice thing, and that's shown by Jelle in his discussed in the DRSSB paper, that this does not depend on the normality of the random effect. So whatever the distribution is, if you take some averaging, you want to have a local test for that averaging. It only depends on the covariance structure of the distribution you put in and not on the distribution itself. So that makes it independent of that. For the normals, you have got a bit of a problem that making sigma squared is unknown. Known is unrealistic, so you have to estimate sigma squared. You have to put it somewhere. So under the null, this will give you an estimate of sigma squared. And you can use this statistic. But in the generalized linear models, like logistic regression, survival analysis, and so on, the sigma squared basically is known. So I'll consider the sigma squared is known case as a prototype for generalized linear models. Will not go into the problem of how to handle the estimation of sigma squared. You can read that, the rest. How do you choose sigma if you want to do this? For p smaller than n, if you take sigma d, covariance matrix of the betas, of the estimated betas, you get back to the likelihood ratio test. But here we take sigma just the identity. That's not quite natural, I come back to that later, but it's in line with penalized likelihoods, rich regression, and so on. Just putting on identity for covariance matrix gives you later on a penalty proportional to beta hat, beta squared, and you get a natural link between this test and doing rich regression in normal data or in generalized linear models. So for the sake of the compatibility, and also because we just don't know how to do it differently, we just take the identity. The distribution and the power depend on the eigenvalues of the x prime or the x prime x matrix. So if you can present everything on the eigenvector basis of either x prime or x prime x, anyhow, the little eigenvalues are the same, and you get that. You can write your test statistic, this one as a sum of non-central chi-squared, this one degrees of freedom. The distribution of this thing is not explicitly known, but there's a lot of literature about how you can compute the probabilities, the p-values in this distribution and the null. And Yale has been done a lot of work and is still doing on getting this as precise as possible, but it's a well-known problem how to get the p-values for this testing problem. The interesting thing is that you find, if you look into it this way, that the test is unbiased, meaning that for any alternative you get a power larger than alpha, but the power depends heavily in what direction the true effect is. So if the betas are in the direction of the large eigenvalues, the eigenvectors corresponding to the large eigenvalues, you get a good power, and if it's the beta is in the direction of the small eigenvalues, you got a small power, and if you have to estimate the variance, you even lose the unbiasedness, and you get a bias test, so you get a power below alpha if the alternative is really in the wrong direction. And you see there's some similarity relationship with doing the slightly more simple-minded but not that bad idea of reducing the dimension by taking the first k eigenvectors of x prime x, yeah, and then testing in the more classical way whether you get global significance when regressing on the first k eigenvectors. Well, if you have an intercept or more predictors, it all gets a bit more complicated. Practically, the formulas get more messy, but ideas do not change very much. Well, could we do this differently? Well, there are different issues. So the issue is, how do we put on mixing distributions? It's getting quite Bayesian. What do we think that are likely distributions for the alternative betas? Yeah. The two things that you could discuss and work on. One is getting a covariance structure that for the betas that reflects somehow the biology, the things that are known. You know that some of the genes are in the same pathway, so maybe the effects of the genes are somehow correlated, so you could try to put pathways in here. There's some work in that direction in the penalized likelihood world, where you get rich penalties within the pathways, and I think L1 penalties between the pathways, things like that. And the other thing is that you could say, well, we should not be doing this at all, because putting distributions on betas is kind of stupid thing, because the betas depend very much on the context. If you leave regressors out, the betas change. So maybe we should put them on the covariances. And if you want to do that, you have to make it, instead of a conditional, unconditional problem. So you have to estimate both the covariance and the covariance matrix of the axis. Yeah. So then we're getting very close to what Peter has been doing. So if you want to extend u-work, you have to estimate the covariance of y with the axis as well. And then you get a kind of robust regressor that could be used for this testing and as general as a predictive model. So these are the things I think we still have to work on, and this whole thinking about what is reasonable way of well, linking penalties with priors gives idea of what penalties could be useful, and just putting in automatically penalties that are okay if the predictors are uncorrelated or independent. Is not naturally okay if they are dependent, and you'd like to have a structure that allows for dependent access. So these are things still to be worked on. Another thing is maybe you should not do it that way at all. Instead of trying to put a model on the betas, you say this induces a model, a correlation model, among the observations. Observations that have correlated x's in this model gives correlated y's. Yeah? So the correlation between the y's is big if the x's are in the same direction. Positive, it's big negative if the x's are in the opposite direction. And I think it's okay that you get high correlations in this model if they are very similar and point in the same direction. But if they have an opposite sign, assuming that they have a correlation minus one, then maybe it doesn't make that much sense. Yeah? Because you expect the things to be similar if they're similar, but if they're completely different, that they point somehow in the opposite direction, that would only give a correlation minus one if you really got a linear effect for the effect of the gene expression data. And maybe that's, in practice, it's just not true. So you could try to modify this by saying, well, this is a kind of covariance structure in between the y's induced by the distances in covariance space, and we could try to generalize that to different spatial correlations in covariance space for the y's. And that's closely related to a goodness of fit test I did with Saskia Lisesi a long time ago. You can use similar models just to test the goodness of fit of the independence model versus the dependence model, and the general goodness of fit test in regression problem is very similar. You fit a model, and the correlation that neighboring points gives correlated residuals is an indication of lack of fit of the model. And that's the kind of thing you can use here, and that has been extended to multinomials recently, because Jelle got interested in doing this thing as well. And in the very beginning of this gene expression hype, if I may say so, I've heard people giving talks in this direction, but I never have been able to reconstruct who actually gave that talk. So the nice thing is looking at in this way, you see that the dimension P has completely disappeared. You have a correlation structure, and it does not depend. It does not matter how you get it, and it does not matter how big the number of covariates is. So you just have to measure similarities in some way. Okay. Well, what's the link with ridge regression? This is well known. Ridge regression, you put a penalty here, you get this estimator, and you get this predictor with this, say, this is replacing the projection matrix that you usually get. This is the slightly shrunken projection matrix of the ridge regression. And there's a very close link to this ridge regression and doing this global test. And this is very, very tradition, very old. It goes back to the 70s to 1970, I think. Howell and Kennett doing that. If you write down the deviant of the mixed model, you can link that to the heuristic regression by saying, well, this is the, first of all, if you do it, you have to this integral, the beta that minimizes it is just the rich regression estimate with lambda equal to 1 over tau squared. So you get the apparent prediction error of that one that comes from comparing the y's with the estimated y's in the rich regression. You get kind of two penalty terms. Kind of this is the usual rich penalty comes into this deviance, and you get next a correction term for the dimension. And I think this is some version of a Bayesian information criterion. And that is linked to the rich regression by this term, and you get some additional penalty types of terms. And the global test just takes the derivative of this deviance with respect to tau squared in tau squared equal to 0, and that gives you the test statistic. And if you do some first order approximations, this kind of head matrix of the rich regression is just proportional to xx prime. And if you do this, you get the global test statistic as this is the derivative of the apparent error with respect to tau squared. This is the derivative of the penalty. And this is the effective dimension of the model term. That gives you these two terms cancel, you get the test statistic back. This is the quadratic in the y's minus its expectation and the null. So you're good to do this visually. You check it, and if you see that it goes up, and you check whether it's significant, and if it doesn't go up at all, you're done. You can go and do something else. Yeah? And you could, well, replace that term by effective dimension if you would like to do that. So the other thing is, whether this helps for predictability. And the original idea, the hope was that if you get a significant result for this global test, that means that you can somehow build a sensible predictor based on this data. And I start wondering whether that's true, yes or no. And that's what I did when I came here in April in the beginning. I just wanted to check whether we somehow could test for the prognostic ability of the data set we have. Would a predictor like this be any good? So what you can do is, for this very similar spirit, you take the rich regression again, because that's easy to handle and mathematically the easiest thing you have. You take the cross-validated prediction error, so you leave one individual out, you fit the model, you could get the prediction, leave that one out, and you get the cross-validated prediction, and you get the cross-validated error. So you take cross-validation to measure it, you get the cross-validated error, you plot it versus the 1 over the penalty, and check whether it goes up or goes down at 0. So hopefully it goes down at 0 significantly. If so, you have some proof that the increase in the decrease in the cross-validated sum of squares is not just due to random noise, but is somehow statistically significant. And instead of just taking the minimal value, that's getting too complicated. If you just can show that the slope of this in this plot is statistically significant, that is some proof that something is going on. Well, if you do that for the normal data, you have this well-known identity that you get the cross-validated residuals by just dividing by 1 minus the diagonal of the S-matrix. And that gets you a simple expression that in this Efron spirit could be written as the cross-validated sum of squares is the apparent sum of squares, and a correction for the optimism, the difference between the real world of new data and the old world of the data on which you fit the model. And this optimism correction is of this order. And if you then take this derivative, you get a test statistic that it's very similar to the test of Kuhmann. The 2 has disappeared, but that's because there was a 2 original here, then you get one term cancelling with another term. But instead of having the expected value subtracted at the end, you have it the diagonal of xx prime in here. That means that the expected value under the absolute null hypothesis, nothing going on, is 0. But the behavior of the whole thing is actually quite different. And that, I think, here I simulated some data. And if you do this, it's a bit hard to find something where, an example where it goes wrong. Yeah. So you have to, if you simulate it, you create data set with x prime x, and then you go for the direction of the small eigenvalues. You take your beta there, and you start seeing something like this. So if I plot the deviance or sum of squares or whatever against the variance or the 1 over the lambda, you see that the apparent sum of squares goes down if you decrease the penalty and increase the variance because you allow more flexibility. The effective dimension gets bigger, so you get smaller sum of squares. If you apply, you compute the Bayesian log likelihood for this data, the Bayesian deviance, in this example, it doesn't change at all. And if you do the cross-validated sum of squares, it goes up. So this is an example where really the lesson is if you try to use this for prediction and you go into the whole thing of rich regression and so on, you make it worse, yeah, than if you don't do it. Yeah. So at the end, the story will be that the optimal penalty is just infinity, and the prediction error for other values of the penalty is bigger. While for the global test, somehow you never can get it worse. But here, it could happen that you get an indication that you just should not do it because you make things worse if you try to use this information. And well, of course, you will find it out if you go to the whole procedure of making this plot over all values of tau squared, and for normal data that's very easy to do. So for normal data, actually you can draw the whole plot, but for more complicated data like survival data we'll be doing next week, computations like this take quite long for high dimensional data, and then it's very nice to know that somehow the optimal value will be 0 and that the best performance will be there without having to go over the whole range of lambdas and go over this computation that could take quite long. But also it's somehow interesting to observe that from a predictive point of view, you just good things. Penalization, doing anything could be worse than not doing anything at all. And to understand what's going on, and That's the kind of the way I generated the data on the previous picture. You get some better understanding what's going on if the diagonal of the X prime matrix is more or less constant. Yeah. So then the diagonal is the average value of the eigenvalues. And since this is, say, the cross product between individuals, usually that all individuals have kind of similar variation in the gene expression, presumably, so this is not that bad to get some idea what's going on. And if you put it in, you the expected value of this test is lambda times lambda minus average lambda times the say the effect of the betas and this in the different directions. And you see that if this is relatively big for the eigenvectors that have an eigenvalue smaller than the average, yeah, you get something negative. So if you want to make an example, you just take beta proportional to the eigenvector with the smallest eigenvalue, and you get a nice negative result. And that's the way I generated this data. Yeah. So if really it points in the wrong direction, doing anything like rich regression is no use at all, and you better don't get started. And the interesting is that somehow you get this observation without having the data at all. Yeah. So you somehow you know in what directions it goes wrong and what directions it goes right. And it's a bit similar to actually to the behavior of this global test of Yellow-Human for unknown variances, but if I just take the generalized linear model in, say, logistic regression or Cox regression, in which I know the standard deviation, this is definitely completely different from what I get in Yellow's global test. So the message is different. That also makes that you have a kind of different testing problem. So, and this is the slope for the average cross-validation plot. So we just want the slope at zero, whether that slope is positive or negative. And it's a bit of an unpleasant testing problem. Because the null hypothesis is not a simple null hypothesis anymore, and the null hypothesis does not specify the distribution of the statistics, so we have to somehow find a worst case. And I looked a little bit into that, I think last week. If I just take the test statistic, I have to go back. If I take this thing, and compare the distribution of it under the strict null hypothesis that the beta is completely zero, or the broader null hypothesis that the expected value is zero, then if the betas are not all zero, this thing spreads out to the extreme values, and it's spreading more than under the strict null hypothesis. So this thing is kind of, you can't use this because this is not, you have no worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is that the effects are very big. And it would be nice if the worst case scenario is the scenario of the strict null hypothesis. And I think you can fix the problem more or less in this way. I have on the next transparencies. I tried. I explored it. It's not foolproof and not fully proofed, definitely. But so what you can do here is you split this thing that's in the core of your quadratic expression in the outcome. This matrix has positive and negative eigenvalues. You could somehow split it in the positive and the negative part, and compute the the contribution of the positive part and the contribution of the negative part, and take flip, you could say, the eigenvalues of the negative part. Yeah? So you check whether the positive part is bigger than the negative part by making this test statistic under this wider null hypothesis. These things have an equal distribution, so this should be centered around 1/2, yeah? And I did some simulation to check how it behaves. If you get compare the distribution under the global null, where the mu's are all zero, and if you start having mu's not equal to zero, that somehow adds, well, if you make it very, it's not quite true, but it's a bit like adding constants to this one, that one, and adding the constants to the two terms just makes the variation in the expression smaller. So the hope is that the stronger null hypothesis, that the thing is just zero, is kind of worst case, and that you can use the testing under that distribution, under that null hypothesis, to come up with a p-value for the more global general test. That's a conjecture that's not yet contradicted by the simulations. The advantage is that there's all kind of software to figure out the distribution of the thing, or you could use permutation tests. If I'm not mistaken, you always think hard about permutations. But this is the kind of thing you could use, and this is in the spirit of this workshop, things that require further research. Yeah, and the things that I will take home from going back after next week are things that still has to be done and still has to be explored. I think that's it with the last transparency, the reference again. Okay?
Question.
Yeah?
Your X's throughout are not random.
No.
Because otherwise, the initial test statistic, where you basically, well, you said it's like bridge regression, it's also like this estimation of the covariance matrix of LeDuan-Wolf, where they basically regularize the covariance matrix by moving it towards the identity. It doesn't change the eigenvalues at all. So I don't think that, I mean, I think somehow there isn't a connection, but maybe there is, I'm not sure. That is, that the fact that the eigenvalues are That all has to do with x. If the x's are random, in your case, they're always fixed. And all
yeah,
that.
But still, if you I think you can learn from looking at a random case. You can learn from saying that it could be bad luck that some of the x's are in your data. Some of the eigenvectors have eigenvalues that are not very realistic. Yeah, so I think since in practice, if you got new data, you got new access, so actually they are random, you better do something about this. So you can improve the performance by somehow taking that into account. Yeah, and not let you lead completely by the direction with the largest eigenvalues, or by somehow making the contribution of those guys a little bit smaller.
I mean, that suggests that there may be more of a link, because the thing with this estimate of LeDuan-Wolf is that it doesn't change the eigenvalues at all. You simply adjust by the identity. The eigenvalues are